The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week, we're taking an in-depth look at the brain and all the fascinating ways that it can fail us. We'll talk to Dr. Sarah Brosnan to find out if humans have an edge over primates when it comes to cooperative strategy. Then we're joined by neuroscientist Tom Stafford to discuss Mind Hacks, his book and website that explore the wonderful weirdness that's going on just beneath your skull. Thanks for sharing your brain with us for the next hour. We think you'll like what you hear. I'm here with Sarah Brosnan, assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at Georgia State University and a member of the Neuroscience Institute. She directs the Comparative Economics and Behavioral Studies Laboratory, and she does research with non-human primates at both the Language Research Center of Georgia State University and the Keeling Center for Comparative Medicine and Research. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Sarah.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So you've conducted a very interesting study on game theory. But before we talk about the study, can you give us some background on game theory itself?
Sure. I think most people are most aware of game theory through the movie A Beautiful Mind, which was about John Nash. And the idea behind game theory is that you can quantitatively assess how individuals are making decisions when they interact with others. In other words, you can make it mathematical. This is particularly useful for me because rather than asking people a bunch of qualitative questions, which you obviously can't do with nonverbal species, you can set up a comparative situation where you design a test, you decide the parameters in advance, which means you decide how much food they're going to get for each decision or how much money they're going to get for each decision, and then you can be more sure that the differences you see between species are actually due to differences in how they make decisions and not differences in how they understand the procedure.
Well, the most well-known example of game theory is probably the prisoner's dilemma. Could you tell us about that?
So the prisoner's dilemma is a game that actually was derived from the idea of two prisoners who have been captured, and they have to decide whether or not to rat one another out to the police. And the really strategic question of interest in the prisoner's dilemma is, do you cooperate with your partner, which gives you both a fairly small payoff, or a short jail term in the case of the prisoners, or do you defect and cheat on your partner, which means that one of you gets a very large payoff, the one who does the cheating, and the one who cooperates doesn't. The prisoner's dilemma has been widely studied because it's believed to actually be a good model of a lot of decisions that humans make in real life. And while it's very difficult to solve in a one-shot situation, which means if you're only playing it once, the best solution if you're playing it multiple times is to cooperate. Obviously, it gets more complicated than that. You get into situations with end-game effects where people know that the game is almost over, so they should go ahead and defect and get the good payoff. But there is strategic uncertainty because your partner always does better not to cooperate. We actually chose to start with the assurance game because it's a simpler game. In the assurance game, the Nash equilibrium, or the payoff dominant outcome, is the best solution for everybody. So if you understand the game, then you should, in fact, cooperate because both you and your partner do better that way.
Well, explain the game.
So the assurance game is also sometimes called the stag hunt game. It, too, is based on a real-life situation, which I'll use to describe it. So the idea is that you and a friend go hunting in the woods, and you're going to take down a stag, which is something that you can't take down without working together. However, along the way, you see a hare run by, and you have the temptation to go and take down the hare, which is a smaller amount of food, but more of a guaranteed source. And the question is, what do you do? Do you assume that your partner is going to cooperate and try and wait for the stag, or do you take the temptation for the smaller reward, which is guaranteed? So lots of people have taken this game into the laboratory, and generally speaking, if you explain it to people, they do very, very well cooperating or waiting for the stag. But you can't explain it, of course, to non-human primates. So our question was, how would individuals, humans and these other primate species, react if we set them up in a situation that mirrored the payoff structure of that game, but we didn't tell them beforehand what was happening?
So who were the players here?
We had three different species that we used. We had humans who were undergraduates who were tested at Chapman University in Orange County, California. And then we also used chimpanzees from two different sites. We had 20 chimpanzees, all of whom were adults, from the Keeling Center at MD Anderson. And we additionally had four chimpanzees from the Language Research Center. Those four chimpanzees were particularly interesting because they were raised in a cognitively enriched environment. So they were taught to use symbols to communicate with humans from a very young age, 6 or 8 weeks of age, and are skilled at these sorts of cognitive tests. So they're the equivalent of having a lot more experience with this sort of thing. And then we also tested 8 capuchin monkeys, which are a small New World monkey from South America, also housed at the Language Research Center.
So what did you have them do then?
It was fairly straightforward. They were tested with a partner from their social group. So the capuchins and the chimpanzees are all group housed, so we tested them with someone else they live with every day. The humans were tested with another undergraduate from Chapman, although they didn't know each other beforehand. And in all cases, with all three species, the two subjects were seated next to one another in front of a human experimenter, and they were each given two tokens, one token which represented stag and one token which represented hare, so one of which was a cooperate and one which was defect. And the subjects, monkey, ape, or human, had to return one of the tokens to the experimenter. And the experimenter then held up the token so that both of the subjects could see what each one had returned, and then held up the appropriate reward, showing them what each partner was going to get, and then gave them the reward. And this was repeated multiple times in a session. And so the subjects had to figure out, as the game was played, what payoff they got depending upon what their partner played.
So before we start talking about the results, there are criticisms of testing primates against humans. Do you think humans have an unfair advantage in a game like this?
Well, absolutely, because humans designed the game. So we are testing other species with a game that we see through our own eyes. So we don't know for sure how the other species understand it. Of course, that's the case whenever we're doing anything with other species. So what we try and do is set things up that they should be able to understand. Most of the primate subjects had experience doing exchange sorts of tasks with humans. And in all of those tasks, they returned tokens and they got rewards. And actually, in an effort to make it more consistent when we used the human subjects, we only used subjects who had already been tested in the economics lab. Not on the same game, obviously, but they had previous experience that you make a decision and you get a payoff in actual cash. So we tried to make the level of incoming experience as similar as possible, obviously given big differences in housing. We also tested socially housed primates who were being tested with individuals from their social group, which, if anything, should have made them more likely to come to cooperative outcomes, at least based on human reactions. And finally, we were very careful to give the humans virtually no instruction. It's very easy to cue humans inadvertently, for instance, by saying things like, today you're going to play a cooperation game, or today you're going to play a competition game, which can cue people to behave one way or another. So we used no terminology along those lines. We had a very short set of instructions that essentially said, you'll make decisions, those decisions will be rewarded, and the experimenter won't answer any questions.
Okay, so who won? Who was most successful?
Well, that depends on how you look at it. So nobody did as well as we expected. I think the most interesting finding was that the humans really didn't do very well. So only about a quarter of the human pairs found the payoff dominant outcome. Now, I emphasize that this doesn't mean that humans can't find a payoff dominant outcome. We know from other studies that they certainly can. But when you put them in the situation where you don't give them instruction or pretesting or show them the payoff matrix, only about a quarter of the human subjects actually found the payoff dominant outcome, which, again, doesn't necessarily mean that they can't. It just means that in this situation where we take away the things that humans are used to, language-based instruction or the ability to speak with one another, they don't do as well. In fact, actually, a number of the humans ended up preferring the what we call the risk-dominant outcome, so the outcome where they both prefer hare. Almost a third of the human subjects did that, and none of the other species showed that preference. What this might indicate is that the humans were simply less likely to explore the parameter space, which means that once they found a solution where they were both getting money, they stopped. whereas the other species were far more exploratory. Now, Capuchins did the worst. Of all of the Capuchins, only one pair found the payoff dominant outcome, and one pair ended up matching their partner, which is a smart solution in the sense that you get paid off every trial. But, of course, it's really smart to match your partner and then figure out that now you should go to cooperating. And the rest of the Capuchins never showed a strategy. The chimpanzees were actually really interesting. The chimpanzees from the Healing Center all lived in social groups. They were typically reared in a social group, a very, very normal situation. And virtually all of them matched their partner. We had a couple who showed no strategy, a couple of pairs who showed no strategy, but none found the payoff dominant outcome. On the other hand, the Language Research Center chimpanzees, which had had all of this cognitive experience, did much better. Virtually all of them found the payoff dominant outcome, and we actually did additional conditions with those particular chimpanzees to try and rule out some really basic level interpretations, like that they were just watching what their partner returned,
right,
or that they had formed a preference for one token and didn't really understand the game, and they continued to do extremely well. So we think in the chimpanzees, what we found evidence of is, not surprisingly, experience makes a big difference in chimpanzees as well as in humans.
Well, something you said just made me think about is sort of the concept of success being potentially problematic. Does success really mean the biggest payout? Because it is quite rational to pick the payout that you get every time.
Right. And my guess is that that becomes more of a philosophical question than anything else. But the humans actually, again, picking the risk dominant outcome, particularly if you're playing in a prisoner's dilemma game, is the smart thing to do. So it's very possible that the humans decided to play the token that guaranteed them an outcome, and they were still pretty good outcomes. They got paid a quarter every time they played hare, versus $1 if their partner also played stag, or nothing if their partner played hare and they played stag. So it was a smart solution. It's intriguing, however, that none of the other primates settled on it, even though we had primates showing most of the other outcomes.
Interesting. So what does this study tell us?
Both a lot and in some sense very little.
Right.
One thing, if I can start with what the study doesn't tell us, what it doesn't tell us is how were people solving the game and how were these chimpanzees able to do this. So this study was very much focused on outcomes, but what this does tell us is that humans and other primates have all been under selective pressures, which apparently led them to prefer these sorts of payoff dominant outcomes in these sorts of games. That implies that the coordination that's required has been selected for in humans as well as other primate species, and starts to indicate that human coordination abilities, which are clearly above those of the other primates, I mean, humans are building city-states and chimpanzees are doing really intriguing group hunting, but it's not on the same level of coordination. It may be that humans have built on top of an existing primate system rather than forming something fundamentally new. One of the things we are doing is additional research with these species to try and figure out whether the cognitive mechanisms that they are using to solve these tasks are the same or different across species.
Really interesting studies you're doing, Sarah. Thanks very much for being here.
Absolutely, and thank you.
And we'll be right back with Tom Stafford, co-author of Mind Hacks, Tips and Tricks for Using Your Brain, after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
I'm here with Tom Stafford. Tom has a PhD in psychology, but enjoys telling people that he's a computational cognitive neuroscientist. Tom co-authored the best-selling Mind Hacks, Tips and Tricks for Using Your Brain, which led to the creation of an award-winning website, mindhacks.com. Thanks for being here, Tom.
It's good to be here.
So let's start with some definitions. What is a computational cognitive neuroscientist exactly?
Well, going backwards, a neuroscientist is a biologist who's interested in the brain, and a cognitive neuroscientist is something halfway between a psychologist and a neuroscientist, someone who's particularly interested in the higher mental functions, and that's those things we think of as really being constitutive of intelligence. So language and reasoning and memory and seeing and understanding the world and those things. And the computational in the computational cognitive neuroscience means that what we try and do, what I try and do in my work, is bring perspectives from mathematics to bear on the way the brain might be doing these intelligent functions. So trying to understand the brain, as psychologists have been doing for a long time, in terms of information processing, and trying to ask general questions about how information could and should be processed, and to bring those questions and perspectives to bear on how humans actually do process information and how our brains process information for us.
And then what would a mind hack be?
Well, that could be different things for different people. But I think what we were thinking of as a mind hack is a small activity or an exercise that tells you something surprising about the human mind, something about the way the brain processes information. So for a computer hacker is someone who understands computer systems in a deep way. They're not just a user. They're something like a builder as well. And a hack is a neat solution to an interesting problem. It's a way of kind of looking under the surface of a system and exploiting what it really does. And so for us, a mind hack is either a trick that you can play on yourself, or it's the thing that the information, the trick, tells you about how your mind works. And obviously we're all experts in our own minds, but what psychologists and cognitive neuroscientists have done over the years is they've shown that by systematically investigating how our minds work, there are things that we don't always notice or we aren't always aware of that are kind of, you know, revealing of a wider picture of how we work mentally.
Okay, last definition. You say the book is about recreational neuroscience. So
yes.
What does that mean?
That means it's neuroscience that you can do for fun, and it's neuroscience that you can do with your friends. It's stuff that you can surprise yourself with or surprise someone else with, you know, as opposed to the professional neuroscience, which is very arduous and sometimes resource intensive. This is try it at home stuff.
You have set this up perfectly, sir.
Thank you very much.
So the first few hacks in the book are all about ways that scientists try to understand what's happening in the brain. And we really could do just a whole show on the first chapter. But let's just start with some of the more technical methods. So first, there's the EEG.
The electroencephalogram. And this means, this is one of the surprising things about the brain. We don't often see our brains. We know notionally that they're there in between our ears. But the brain is essentially an electrochemical machine. It processes information by signals being sent between neurons, between brain cells. And those signals generate kind of electrical signatures. And those signatures can actually be detected by placing electrodes on the scalp. You don't need to go underneath the skull or anything. You can actually see some emanations of our neuronal activity just by recording from the scalp. And that's what the EEG machine does. It takes those recordings, and by processing and comparing recordings at different times and in different situations, we hope to learn something about the underlying neuronal activity, where in the brain it originates, and particularly the timing information is revealed by the EEG, when things happen.
And it's been used in all kinds of research.
Absolutely.
I would love some examples.
Let me give an example which I don't have the references and the facts and figures to hand. But some memory researchers noticed in the EEG trace years ago that when you see something that you have seen before, there is a very early difference in the EEG trace. And so, you know, if I show you if I take something from your home without you knowing, and then I show it to you in the laboratory, you might, after half a second or a second and a half, you might say, oh, that's my shoe, or oh, that's that jug I have on the shelf at home. But much earlier than that, in a tenth of a second, there will be a difference in the EEG trace between you looking at an object that you've seen before and an object that you haven't seen before. So it's a sort of an automatic, unconscious, a trace of the recognition that you later have consciously. And what the what this insight was later used to do was, as people are working on developing an EEG, what would you call it, a lie detector of sorts.
Right.
So if I say I have never seen this candlestick or this library or this person before, you could then potentially show the person these objects that they've seen before and objects they haven't seen before, and the critical object, the piece of evidence about which you're curious. And then by comparing the EEG trace, their brain may give a signal that they really have seen it before, even though they themselves might not be willing to say.
That sounds brilliant, but they do have some fairly serious limitations, don't they?
Yes. This is a research direction for EEG. But the problem with EEG recordings is they're very noisy, which is what we call signals that we that vary in ways we don't understand is noise. And so it's not like there's a very high reliability of this kind of technique at the moment. As an example, it's a potentially interesting direction, but I don't think they're going to be strapping people into EEG lie detectors anytime soon.
I actually found it interesting. There are actually websites for building your own open source EEGs. So they are relatively inexpensive. That's an advantage.
They're cheaper than those the functional magnetic resonance imaging machines that they have in hospitals, which cost millions and millions.
Well, tell us about those.
The functional magnetic resonance imager, or fMRI machine, is responsible for those glorious technicolor images of the inside of the brain that you have seen in your newspapers. And journalists and magazines love these images because they show a brain with bright colors. And the colors are not really there, but when we say the brain lights up, what we mean is we spend 6 months of doing highly technical statistical analysis, and we overlay our image of the brain with a kind of a color map, an artificial color map of the parts of the brain that are most active. And the F in fMRI stands for this activity, the function. And we hope to the fMRI shows activity in the brain as you are doing something. So we can show someone an emotional face and then look and see which part of the brain becomes more active relative to an unemotional face, say.
Well, what's the difference between the fMRI and the EEG?
Well, the fMRI shows you activity very precisely located in space. So you can see in 3D where the activity is, if it's in the middle of the brain, the front of the brain, the back, so on and so forth. But it doesn't show it very precisely located in time. So you know roughly what second something is happening, but not what millisecond. Whereas with the EEG machine, because you're recording from the scalp, you don't know precisely where the activity is arising. You might know roughly, you know, the front or the back, but not precisely where. But you do know exactly when the activity is arising. So you get what's called fine temporal resolution, but lower spatial resolution. And the fMRI is the opposite. So they complement each other nicely in that way.
We've actually brought up the fMRI on the show quite often, but I find it really interesting. So what does it actually tell us, though? I understand, you know, we can see brain activity happening, but what does that tell us?
Ah, well, that is an excellent question, if I may say so. And one of my pet hates is the claim that by understanding something about how the brain works, we've automatically superseded any knowledge about how the mind works or about our own experience of human behavior. So it's very, very interesting to know the brain states that go along with mental states or go along with behaviors. But what extra information does that bring aside from satisfying an abstract curiosity in the biology of the brain? Well, not always a lot. Knowing where in the brain a psychological function happens is not necessarily informative on its own. It can tell us surprising things if, say, for example, two things that we thought were separate are processed in the same part of the brain, then, you know, that might be a clue for further investigations. But ultimately, for human psychology, the answers we seek about psychological questions are often best answered behaviorally. So if we want to know how to recover from heartbreak or how to treat someone who's got schizophrenia or how to study best for an exam, those questions are all going to be asked by doing experiments and doing investigations concerned with people's feelings about heartbreak, people's response to treatment for schizophrenia, and people's studying for exams and performance on exams. Knowing what's going on in the brain at the same time provides clues as how to look and where to look, but it doesn't solve these problems on its own. And there's a lot of curiosity-driven fMRI, which generates wonderful pictures, but in my opinion is not very interesting in itself.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. My guest is Tom Stafford, co-author of Mind Hacks, Tips and Tricks for Using Your Brain. So you actually do have a hack on this topic in Chapter 1. It demonstrates how thinking hard can actually raise your heart rate, and I love this one. Can you explain it?
Yes, it's my great pleasure. Now, this was actually contributed to the book by Vaughan Bell, who has gone on to be a great friend and writes most of the material for mindhacks.com currently. And the basis of this hack is really to illustrate this somewhat surprising fact that we are, in fact, thinking meat, and that the brain, which is this organ of thought and the seat of all of our experiences and feelings, is ultimately a machine, and like a machine, it needs fuel, and that fuel is supplied to it via the blood. The sugar and oxygen that the brain needs to run comes via the blood. And if you're thinking more, then the brain machine is working harder, so it recruits more blood supply. And you can actually see this by doing a quick comparison of the blood supply to the brain when you're idling, not thinking about anything particularly, and the blood supply when you're doing an entirely imaginary but cognitively demanding task. So this is the procedure that Vaughan recommends to illustrate to yourself that your brain is recruiting a blood supply when you're thinking. It says to take your carotid pulse, which is the heartbeat that you can feel on either side of the front of your neck, just below the angle of the jaw. You use a very light pressure with just a couple of fingertips next to the windpipe, and you should, you or your friend should be able to feel your pulse with very little trouble. And you take your pulse over 30 seconds, say, when you're just sitting staring at the wall in front of you. And then, like a lot of experiments in cognitive neuroscience, you're going to do a comparison, and that is to see what your pulse is, what your blood supply through your carotid is in a comparison condition when you're thinking hard. And to do this, you're going to do what's called a verbal fluency task. And this involves generating as many names or words as possible in a short time, say the 30 seconds that you're going to take your pulse. So so what you should do is if you're taking let's say you're taking your friend's pulse, and you should say to them, okay, you have 30 seconds to think of as many animals as possible, and then for 30 seconds they will be completely silently, not moving, trying to think of different animals, and they'll be going through different strategies. Animals that begin with A, antelope, aardvark, armadillo, animals that you might find in the jungle, tiger, lion, you know, animals you might have as pets. You know, they'll be cycling through all these different strategies and trying to come up with different animals, and that will be getting their brain working their memory, their imagination, their visualization, and their pulse should go up in the second session, demonstrating that the brain has recruited more blood, more fuel to supply it.
I'd just like to point out that this is the kind of thing that my coworkers are forced to do on a regular basis. So thank you.
They're forced to do verbal fluency tasks.
Yes, this is what I come to work with. Hey, guys,
right.
Let's try this. Yeah.
Okay.
No, they're probably quite tired of me. But let's speak about sort of something related, neurons. You mm-hmm. devote a few pages in the book to the anatomy and function of neurons. So
yes.
Maybe just explain what a neuron actually is.
A neuron is a cell with a particular capacity that you don't find in the same way in other cells. It can send a signal called an action potential by neuroscientists, which is a change in electrical potential along its length, and the other a particular structural structural characteristic of neurons is that they have long branches, as you might call it, called axons, which send this signal to other neurons. So you can imagine them like starfish with elongated legs maybe trees, you know, long branches, all connected together.
Right. So you actually make a really interesting point about the way neuron signaling works. You say that people don't work like elevator buttons.
An elevator button. You press it and the elevator comes. Unlike what people seem to believe, if you press the elevator button lots of times, you keep pressing it, the elevator doesn't come any faster. There's no way you can send a stronger signal to cool the elevator. You just have to press it and wait, however frustrating that is. The brain isn't like a simple on-off signal processor. The brain processes signals of different strengths. You can have lots of neurons involved in transmitting the signal, or you can have fewer neurons or a less strong signal. So an example would be, imagine you're waiting at a traffic light and you're waiting for it to go green, and you want to, you know, you want to start the accelerator on your car as soon as it goes green. Well, research has shown, surprisingly, that even though you may be fully committed to going as fast as possible from the green signal, a stronger green light will let you get away faster than a weaker green light. That you can actually recognize, process, and respond to a stronger signal quicker than even a perfectly obvious but weaker signal, which is a sort of surprising fact in it about the way the brain processes information. And it stems directly from the fact that it's not a simple system which is has states which are either on or off, but it's actually a signal processing system that uses neurons that can transmit signals of different strengths.
And this also works with the loudness of sound, correct?
Absolutely, yes. And it works for the strength of taste. So if you told people to press accelerator as soon as they tasted something, or more of a particular substance would allow them to respond quicker than less, even though both might be perfectly obvious. To our subjective perspective, you know, a faint green light might be as obvious as a very bright green light, but the bright green light makes a signal that travels through us, through to our foot on the accelerator faster.
But there are limits as well to this. I'm actually thinking of Perrin's law.
Yes. Well, there's a limit to how quickly you can respond to something. And obviously, once you start to press up against that limit, no increase in the brightness of a light or the loudness of a sound will make you go faster than your maximum.
I'm going to revert to 6-year-old here again. Why? Why is there a maximum, but why does the reaction time change based on the intensity of the stimulus? Do we know?
Well, I think we know. I don't know if everyone would agree with me that we think we know, or would agree with my answer. It's to do with, this is really about the computational part in the computational neuroscientist. So it's to do with the fundamental ways in which you can integrate information over time. And it's actually a very interesting and important point. So if you imagine that you are your brain. Now, if you are your brain, you do not know that there is a green light there. You, the person, you know, knows at any moment whether the light is green. But that sense of certainty has been delivered to you by the processing your brain does. If you're a part of your brain, let's say the part of the brain that's waiting to send the signal to your muscles to press the foot on your accelerator, you are receiving signals from other parts of the brain all the time, and those signals will have noise in them, random variation. And some part of those signals, presumably, is indicating whether the light has gone green yet. So let's say it's a green light signal for convenience, and that green light signal will not be on or off. It will always be teetering at very weak or when the light's probably off, or it will be at very strong when the light is probably on. And your job is to press the accelerator at some point between the signal changing from very weak, indicating the light is off, to very strong, indicating that the light is on. And obviously you want to trigger the accelerator pedal as soon as possible. So you've got a statistical problem, really. You don't get given clean information if you're a neuron or a group of neurons on the inside of the brain. You have to extract from the uncertain firing of the neurons the probable state of the world outside. And if you define more formally, in more mathematical language, what I've just roughly said, then you end up with a statistical situation where the brain always has to be guessing about the likely state of the outside world, and that the best guess it can make is influenced in a predictable way by the strength of the signal that arrives in the form of the brightness of the light or the loudness of the sound.
You know, maybe you're tired of this, but this is fascinating. Are you still fascinated by this?
I am still fascinated, and thank you very much for asking the question. I don't think I've ever had a chance to talk about computational cognitive neuroscience in this way. So it's a great pleasure. What makes brain science so fascinating is you have fundamental theoretical insights from computer science and from mathematics. You have historical biological insights from what we know about the evolution of the brain and the brain as an actual object with an evolutionary history. And then we have those human insights from psychology about the way people behave and the way they feel and think in different situations. And, you know, we're here in the middle of all of this trying to reconcile those three things.
Actually, on that note, something else that I found really interesting was the concept of neuropsychology, the study of what different parts of the brain do by studying people who no longer have those parts.
So this is actually one of the oldest of the systematic sciences of the mind, and that is the investigation of what happens to people when they suffer damage that removes a part of their brain. And so as I've already been saying, your thoughts and your feelings and your memories and experiences and everything arise from this biological machine between our ears. And like any machine, it can become damaged or it can break down. And like all machines, it's got particular parts that do things. It's not just a soup or a gloop, a homogenous mess. And so you might expect, and this is borne out by the evidence, that when very specific parts of the brain are damaged, you find particular losses of function. So a very good example would be that people who suffer specific damage to the area of the brain at the back of the head, called the occipital lobe, tend to have problems with seeing, with their sight. And that is because that part of the brain appears to be specialized for processing visual information. And you can carry this logic on. Although it's obviously very unfortunate for people who suffer this kind of brain damage, there's a history of doctors trying to match up the physical damage in people with brain damage with the things that they now find difficult or impossible to do in behavior.
Well, one of the things that this also does is it sort of debunks the myth that we only use 10% of our brains, right?
Absolutely, which is a very persistent myth. And I always say to people, well, you know, which 90% of your brain would you be happy to lose? And obviously, you're using all of it. It's interesting. Like most myths, there's a grain of truth in this. And I think that the grain of truth is based in a bit of a confusion between mind and brain. And what the grain of truth is that you have much more potential. that you could learn to do. For every thing you can do now, there are 10 other things you could have learned instead, and you could still learn instead. You speak English, but if you'd been born in China, then you would have grown up being able to speak Chinese. And if you'd been born in Spain, you'd have grown up being able to speak Spanish, and you could still learn those languages. Where it's the brain is an interesting machine, because it is a machine that changes itself, and it can grow and adapt to our experiences and our environment. And that's the truth at the heart of the 10% myth.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. We're talking about the book Mind Hacks with co-author Tom Stafford. So let's talk about attention. Now, there's a lot of visual information involved in this topic, and you do talk about the visual aspects of all this throughout the book, but since we're on the radio, that makes it difficult, and we'll limit ourselves a bit. But I did want to mention a few of the topics here that were really interesting. So in hack number 39, for anyone following along in their copy, you make a distinction between attention and noticing.
What we meant when we said that trying to draw a distinction between attention and noticing is that attention is actually a very is a group of things. It's a bunch of processes which your brain uses to cut out information before it comes to awareness. But it's also the kind of the effortful direction of your ability to notice things. It's the effortful direction of your focus to particular aspects of your environment. Noticing is the very specific process of things coming to your awareness. You notice your shoelaces are undone, or you notice that there's the light has turned green.
So in hack number 39, then, you talk about something called the attentional blink.
Yes, this is great fun and a staple of research psychology. And this is the attentional blink is a kind of experimental phenomena that shows that our ability to notice things varies with time. And in particular, our ability to notice things suffers a lapse. It drops immediately after we've paid attention to something else. So typically what you would do in one of these experiments is you would look at a series of letters, and they would be appearing rapidly on a screen in front of you, or you'd be listening to a series of sounds. And you'd be told to pay attention for, the letter X and the letter Y, say. And the letters are appearing at random in front of you. And the attentional blink is that if you have just spotted an X and a Y appears pretty immediately afterwards, you're less likely to spot that Y than if it just appeared on its own. So I think an everyday example of this, which maybe listeners can relate to, is where you're looking for something in a list and you can't spot it because there's something else in your list next to it which keeps drawing your attention, and then you dismiss it. So say you're looking for the name Tom in a list, and you look down the list and you keep seeing Tim just above it, and you go, oh no, I'm looking for Tom, not Tim. And then you kind of, you'll have that blink, that blip in your attention, which will cause you to skip over both Tim and Tom and go on to another bit of the list where your target is not.
How does one avoid that then? Is there a hack for the hack?
Maybe that will have to be in Mind Hacks too.
So I'm just wondering, could you read slower?
I think you could read slower, yes. And that's how we often notice the thing. When we know that the word Tom is in the list of names and we haven't found it, we slow ourselves right down, and eventually we notice it there next to Tim. So the interesting thing about the attentional blink is it follows a particular pattern in time. So it takes a tenth or a twentieth of a second to build up, and it's there for maybe a tenth of a second or maybe two tenths of a second, which is long enough to for your eyes to move over a couple of items. And then it goes away again. This your attentional function is restored. So actually, if you were only looking at an item every second, you wouldn't suffer it.
So really, the answer is slow the heck down, people.
Well, I mean, the interesting thing about all these phenomena is we're really looking at a system that's designed to work at some kind of limit all the time. You want to, your advantage from having a brain is that it allows you to do things quickly, notice things quickly, respond quickly. And so often you see these features or bugs, depending on how you look at them, when at the limits of performance. which is, of course, where we want to live.
On that note, actually, I was also intrigued by something called subitizing.
Subitizing, yes. Most people do not realize that there are actually two kinds of number sense that we have. There's the one called counting, which we all know about, 8, 9, 10, 11. And then there's the instant appreciation of number, which is called subitizing. And so this is where if someone shows you two apples and says, how many apples are there? You don't count 1, 2. You just know there are two apples. And if they show you three apples, you'll probably just know there are three. You don't need to count 1 apple, 2 apple, 3 apples. This sense, this subitizing sense, breaks down beyond a certain limit. You know, 3, 4 for most people, maybe a bit higher for some people. And then, you know, if you see a bowl of a number, 8 apples, you're not going to immediately know there are 8. You're probably going to have to count them. But you can do it quicker by mentally dividing them into 2 groups, and then you can subitize 2 lots of 4 and add them up. That's my tip for fast counting for you there.
Ooh. Well, and that's the thing. You were sort of speculating in the book that they were 2 different processes, counting and subitizing.
Yes, I think that's fairly well acknowledged now. This subitizing happens rapidly, so it takes you as long to say 1 apple as it does to say 2 or 3. Whereas if you show someone 19, 20, or 21 apples, it takes them an extra bit of time to say 20 rather than 19, and an additional extra bit of time to say 21 rather than 20. You know, the increase in time shows that people are spending an amount of time to count each apple, whereas with subitizing, it happens the same for these small, in the same amount of time for these small numbers. So that timing information is kind of one of the ways, it's a classic way psychologists use to try and understand the processing underlying the behavior.
And I would like to point out that now that we've mentioned this, everybody listening to this episode will never be able to not notice that again. Or at least that's my problem.
Yes, and there's some fascinating research that shows that you can actually train this ability to subitize. So there's some great work from some psychologists in the States who noticed one day that I think it was a PhD student noticed that he played a lot of action video games, things like Medal of Honor, where you have to shoot baddies very rapidly. He also was very, very good at subitizing. And he thought, well, maybe this need to kind of constantly process visual information very rapidly has trained my ability. And so he got action video game players and compared them to normal people of the same age and, you know, intelligence and everything else, and found that they were better subitizers. They could instantly count up to 4 or 5, whereas most of us can only do 2 or 3.
So what you're saying is there are advantages to playing video games.
Well, you get better at some of the skills required, yes.
You've made some members of our audience very happy, sir.
Just trying to give you the facts.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm talking with Tom Stafford, co-author of Mind Hacks, Tips and Tricks for Using Your Brain. And we'll be right back with more after the break.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, it's an hour on water. Dr. William James joins us for a lesson on the history and technology of municipal water systems. And we'll talk to University of Toronto researcher Dr. Mark Grinpas about the science and safety of water fluoridation. From the Roman aqueducts to the latest research on what happens when you turn the tap, next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 Mountain Time at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm here with Tom Stafford. Most recently, Tom authored an e-book on psychology, morality, and the nature of stories, The Narrative Escape. But we're talking today about another book that he co-authored, Mind Hacks, Tips and Tricks for Using Your Brain. So you've written an entire chapter on hearing and sound, which is perfect for the radio.
Yes, absolutely.
So you say that where sight is primarily used to track the location of things, sound is more about tracking when things happen? What do you mean by that?
Sight and sound, not just the same thing in different formats. As sensors, they're specialized for telling you, for giving you different kinds of information about the world. And if you imagine your eyes as cameras, crudely, you have millions of pixels of resolution on the back of your eyes. So you can tell in space where something is very precisely. Well, the equivalent with your ears, with sound, is that you have two ears. So you've got a sort of, the resolution is very, very much less for space. And though it's, you know, a remarkable story about how you do identify where sounds come from. But what this means is when you try and combine information across the senses, your brain will weight information about a location in space from vision higher than it will weight information about location in space from your hearing, which is why ventriloquism works, because your eyes tell you that the dummy's lips are moving,
right,
and your ears will tell you the sound is coming from the person holding the dummy, and then the location information is weighted by your brain, you know, it's given priority from vision. The vision says, look, I can see the lips moving, that's where the sound is. And actually, an everyday, I don't know when the last time you went to a ventriloquist show was, but an everyday example of this is at a lecture or in the cinema, where you see the speaker or the person in the movie talking directly ahead of you, and the sound is actually coming from speakers on either side. But you can try this next time you're at a lecture. Close your eyes, and you will hear the sound coming from the side. And then when you open them, your brain will do this automatic kind of jiggery-pokery where it will produce the illusion that you're hearing the sound from what you see, the place, the person that you see in front of you.
This is brilliant. I love this stuff. Also, the brain has a mechanism for filtering out echoes. I didn't realize that.
And this is kind of one of the things that gives particular locations their kind of the characteristic sound, is that, you know, everything around us sends back an echo. And your brain, when the echoes come back quickly enough, so that when they're from a wall, an internal wall in a building, say, your brain will edit them out. So they add flavor, if I can use that metaphor, they add flavor to the sound you're hearing, but they don't sound separate. So there are echoes around us all the time. It always echoes acoustically in the physical sound waves. They're always there. It's only when you go to a canyon or, you know, a giant hall and you shout and then the echo comes back half a second or a second later. It's only then that you notice it as a separate sound. If it comes back too rapidly, then your brain sort of automatically bundles it with the original sound. That's called the Haas effect.
Well, talking about bundling, you also talk about the ability of the brain to sort out those meaningful sounds from the background noise.
And this is about the idea of attention again, and that we have this ability to identify in a kind of a stream or a bundle of confusing information, like, you know, say all the voices around us in a crowded room, the one we're listening to.
Now, there are just too many, sir, too many fascinating topics in this book, and we're not going to be able to cover or really even make a dent in most of them. But there are a few more that I just wanted to touch on before we wrap up. Can you tell us what a body schema is?
Body schema is your mind's image of what shape your body is and where it is in space. So this is one of those things that you only notice when it goes wrong. So most of the time I take for granted that I know where my feet are, I know where my fingers are, it's only if I can surprise myself that I realize that actually it's not that is not a fact which I have direct access to. This is an idea which there are mental mechanisms for constructing, and that idea can be tricked. So a good example is if you... this is going to be impossible to describe on the radio. There's a trick where you interlace your fingers, and then while your arms are crossed and your fingers are facing away from you, and then you turn them so the interlaced knuckle is facing towards you. Do you have that in Canada?
We do.
So if you do that, you get someone else to do that, and then you point to a finger and ask them to wiggle it. They will often wiggle one of the fingers on the wrong hand, and that's because this crossing of the hands across the body midline has confused the body schema, so they've lost the kind of automatic identification of which finger is where. So that's a very simple example of how your body schema can be confused. And there's an even more powerful one is the phantom hand illusion, where you take an artificial hand, place it on a table, and you take your own hand and have it underneath the table, and someone strokes the hand under the table and the fake hand on the table in synchrony at the same time. And in lots of people, they are overcome by a powerful illusion of body schema, that the fake hand that they can see being stroked is actually their real hand. Their knowledge of where their real hand is fuzzy enough that they like you, mislocalize the sound of the speaker to the image on the video projector rather than to the sound on the, to the sound coming out of the loudspeakers. You mislocalize the sensation of your hand being stroked to the visual place where you can see an artificial hand being stroked.
And just for reference, there are literally thousands of YouTube videos about this exact topic with this experiment.
Oh, good. Yes. Well, it's a classic, and it's viscerally shocking. I mean, there's kind of sort of analogs of this. So if you've ever been on a train facing another train, and that train has started moving, you suddenly kind of have the you ask for a moment, "Whoa, was I moving and I didn't realize?"
So maybe if you could hazard a guess, why do you think our brains do these kind of things? Like, would you consider this faulty, or would you just consider this accommodating for other things?
That's a really good question, and this is one of the themes that runs through the book, and one of the themes of sort of contemporary psychology. Are these errors, mistakes? Are they just flaws, or are they there for a reason? Are they, in computer speak, bugs, or are they features? And I guess, you know, you'd have to consider them case by case, but for the most part, these things are built into the brain because they are the best, quickest way of processing information. And the thing about the way our brains have to process information is that there's never enough time to do all the processing you might want. There's never enough certainty. The information you're getting is never clean enough. It's never like free from distortion. And in a world where there's limited time, and you know, information is often corrupted or you know, incomplete, you have to make best guesses about the world. And so what psychologists have really done with providing all these hacks, these phenomena that we discuss in the book, is they have given us a kind of a menagerie of illustrations of ways in which the brain makes do, does the best it can with the limited information available. And it provides us most of the time with the illusion of certainty that we know what's really going on in the world. And this reality I look at is really there, when really it's an illusion constructed by our brains to help us act in the world.
Audience, please, there is so much information in this book that we didn't get to. You really need to read this, and you too can annoy your friends and family with all of the hacks. Thanks very much for being here, Tom.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Things that Tom Stafford finds interesting are posted on his website at idiolect.org.uk. There's a link to his site at our site at skepticallyspeaking.com. And while you're there, please do click the links to Twitter, to Facebook, and to iTunes, where you can listen to archived episodes, subscribe to the show, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Kia ora. I'm Carly Sturgis, host of the Token Skeptic podcast, here to ask you to lend a hand to the people of New Zealand. The city of Christchurch was devastated by a magnitude 6.3 earthquake in late February. The damage was serious and widespread, and you can help the city and its people as they recover from this disaster. The Red Cross of New Zealand is collecting donations. Anything that you can spare will help. Please go to redcross.org.nz to learn how you can donate.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell, gonna raise a little hell. Break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking. Online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan. Who, I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the
brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor. Leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier. Reading in between the lines of these lies, bring it on. The skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're skeptically speaking.